Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
What text is it?
Raja Pradhanan Mahatas Trilingo Daiva Choditat Jatat Sasarja Bhutadiyu Vyadadini Panchashah
Vyadanani Panchashah
Raja Pradhanan Mahatas Trilingo Daiva Choditat Jatam Sasarja Bhutadiyu Vyadadina Vyadadini Panchashah
Vyadadani Panchashah
Rajat Pradhanat. In which the element of rajas or passion predominates. Mahataha. From the Mahatattva.
From the Mahatattva.
Trilingaha.
Trilingaha.
Of three kinds.
Of three kinds.
Daiva Choditat.
Daiva Choditat.
Impelled by superior authority.
Impelled by superior authority.
Jataha. Was born.
Was born.
Sasarja.
Sasarja.
Evolved.
Evolved.
Bhuta Adihi. The false ego.
The false ego.
Origin of the material elements.
Origin of the material elements.
Viyat.
Viyat.
The ether.
The ether.
Adini.
Adini.
Beginning with.
Beginning with.
Panchashaha.
Panchashaha.
In groups of five.
In groups of five.
Translation in purport by His Divine Grace, Srila Prabhupada. As impelled by the destiny of the jiva, the false ego, which is of three kinds, evolved from the Mahatattva, in which the element of Rajas predominates. From the ego in turn, evolved many groups of five principles. Purport. The primordial matter or Prakriti, material nature, consisting of three modes, generates four groups of five. The first group is called elementary and consists of earth, water, fire, air, and ether. The second group of five is called tanmatra, referring to the subtle elements, the sense objects, sound, touch, form, taste, and smell. The third group is the five sense organs for acquiring knowledge. Eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and skin. The fourth group is the five working senses, speech, hands, feet, anus, and genitals. Some say that there are five groups of five. One group is the sense objects, one is the five elements, one is the five sense organs for acquiring knowledge, another is the senses for working, and the fifth group is the five deities who control these divisions. This is a very fixed, regulated pattern of creation. It all occurs according to the strict rules of material nature. Of course, this is the law of God. The Supreme Personality is in control of material nature. Maya dyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam. It is under my superintendence that my supervision, we can say supervision, adyaksha means vision, supervision, looking from above. So by my supervision, prakriti, the material nature, creates all moving and non-moving beings. And she does this under strict control. She is dictated to by the desire of the Supreme Person. Jai Shri Krishna Balaram. She is not acting at all independently. And then she, in turn, is imposing very strict regulation upon the material creation. Being put into such a situation, the living entities who enter this material world also will be strictly regulated. By entering the material world, one's freedom becomes strictly, very severely restricted. No matter, there are degrees of freedom in material life, but basically we're very much restricted. Just by the predominance of these regulating principles. This is not our real life. Our real life belongs to the spiritual world. We are creatures of the spiritual world. Although we are called marginal potency, we're in between the material and the spiritual. Actually, our nature is spiritual. We are spiritual sparks, not material sparks. We're spiritual sparks who are susceptible to becoming influenced by matter because we're small. But it's not the other way around. We're not material things that have some spiritual qualities. That's wrong understanding. The right understanding is we are basically spiritual, but the material energy, being another energy of the Supreme Lord, Shigornitai, it shouldn't be so that the spiritual particle is predominated over by the inferior material energy. Why should conscious life be controlled by dead matter? It isn't, though. The control is the control of the Supreme Lord. Matter becomes empowered by the desire and the intention of Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. His incarnation for creation, the Purusha, beginning with Mahavishnu and his two other expansions, they are God, and they impose their desire upon the inert material nature. But not directly. There is a deity, Prakriti. She is also a person. She's the presiding deity of the dead matter, but she's not dead matter. She is the direct expansion of Krishna's internal pleasure potency, but she's the external potency. But also alive, also a person. But she is specially empowered by the Supreme Person to keep everybody in material life under strict control. She predominates not by her own strength, but that by the power of Krishna that is imparted on her, upon her. She's empowered to keep us, to put us in illusion and keep us there. But that is not our real life. We've been living this material life for so long, we're so accustomed and conditioned to it, that it's hard for us to conceive of any other life. But our real life is under different conditions of freedom. These restrictions don't exist in the place that we actually came from. the limitation or the delimitation of the separate elements, each of the elements, earth, water, fire, air, ether, and the subtle elements, have their separate qualities. One cannot act like the other. One cannot become the other. Air does not become ether. Mind does not become earth. They stay separate, and they have their separate qualities. You cannot do with earth what you can do with ether. Not all the same qualities. Although the grosser elements contain the qualities of the subtler elements. So you can do some things. You can transmit sound through the ether. But you can also transmit sound through earth. Because the quality of sound in here is in the earth also. And in the water. So sound, we can see for ourselves that sound passes through water, it passes through earth. That is there, but still there are severe restrictions. You can't, it's not the other way around. The quality of earth, smell, fragrance, is not found in the ether. The quality of visible form that belongs to fire is not found in the ether. The ether is devoid of all these qualities and cannot function, cannot do the things that the grosser elements do. So, and that's just the beginning of our restrictions. Time is making everything happen in a regulated fashion. There is restriction of past, present, and future. Once you do something, you cannot undo it. Once you waste one moment of your life, you can never get that one moment back. You cannot undo anything that happens because of the imposition of the control of time. And then once time takes over, then so many restrictions are imposed. Each living entity has what is called his karma, which is the complex of all the things, the reactions to all the things he has done in the past. And those reactions are coming in the present, and more will come in the future, and they are regulated. So strictly regulated that an intelligent man who knows the science of astrology, just by knowing the time of your birth, or by knowing the time of some event that you want to predict, I want to see whether it's a good day to start my business next Friday, to start a corporation. I ask the astrologer to see, whether for that activity it's an auspicious time. So the astrologer is just by calculating the time, that's all he does. And then according to the time, he looks at the position of the different planets at that moment of time. And he can predict so many things. If he's expert, he can predict many things. Because everything is regulated by time. If you know the time, you know what's going to happen in the future. There's no necessarily great mystic power involved. You just have to be a good calculator and know the rules. This is the severe restriction of material life. There are no such restrictions. And each individual living entity has his own karma, his own entanglement, represented first of all by the body that he's living in, which imposed so many restrictions on him. If my body has some deformity, some weakness, I have to live with that. Some congenital disease, I have to live with that and suffer the restrictions of it for my whole life. If my intelligence is limited, that is my prarabdha karma, I have to suffer that my whole life. If I'm born in a poor family, and I just don't have the good fortune to earn wealth, I will be poor for my whole life. This is my prarabdha karma. So many restrictions. And everybody is suffering restrictions, just there are different degrees. The person in the mode of goodness has relatively less restriction, more freedom. But it's only a matter of relative degree. Anyone who enters in the material world is entering into the realm of restriction, of loss of freedom. Compared to the situation of anybody in the spiritual world in Vaikuntha. It is much less undesirable. If you know the difference of life in this world, even in the best, most prosperous, most powerful position, compare that to life of anybody in the spiritual world. If you knew the difference, if you could see, then you would for certain choose the spiritual world. You have to be foolish to want the inferior thing when you're offered both the lesser thing and the better thing. Here, you want to purchase an item for the same price. I have a poorly manufactured one and I have a much better one for the same price. Which one do you want? They're both available in my shop. You can have either one. And I'll show you how the better one is better. After you see that, unless you're foolish, you're not going to save any money if they're both the same price. You're foolish to take the inferior one. The salesman is being honest. He's showing you the difference. So if we know the difference, we have to choose the better one, unless we're just self-destructive. Our problem is we don't know. We go to a shop, the shopkeeper never tells the truth. Whatever he has is the best. Maya is telling us that also. This garbage is the best thing. This junk is the best and the cheapest price. So we're being deluded constantly, thinking, being told, and believing it, because we don't have any better information. That the useless things in this world, the shoddy goods that are available in this world, are actually desirable, and more desirable than anything else we can imagine. That's the avaranatmika shakti of Maya, covering us, to make us think that the trash that we're given to enjoy in this world is actually desirable, and that there is nothing better. Ignorance. It's only because of that ignorance that we agree to remain an illusion. Otherwise, if we had knowledge of the better thing, of course we would give up this inferior world in a short time. The key is to get that knowledge, to get out of ignorance. Tamasi ma jyotir gomaya. Get out of the darkness. Go to the light. Why? The moth is attracted to the light for his own destruction. Nashaya patanti pang patang. Was it patanga? The moths are running into the light, the candle, because they're helplessly, by instinct, attracted to light. And they burn up in the flame. So, in itself, being attracted to light is not always beneficial. It may be destructive. Why is it better to go to the light? Why not remain in the ignorance? You could say, well, if I knew how horrible this world was, I couldn't tolerate living here. Better I remain in ignorance. Better I tolerate the horrible life of this world, because I'm here anyway. Let me remain in ignorance and at least tolerate my existence. There's a story, I guess you say a parable, or it's called the myth, told by Plato. Okay, he's a Mlecha, but among the philosophers in the West, Socrates and his disciple Plato, who wrote down, Socrates didn't write anything, but Plato recorded the teachings of Socrates. So Prabhupada says he was the first philosopher in the West and the last. The first real philosopher, and after him, everyone was inferior. So the first and last real philosopher in the Western world, Socrates. And then Plato was his, who recorded what he said. So one dialogue of Plato recording the teachings of Socrates. Socrates is telling a story. Fiction, not meant to be taken as history, but to teach a lesson. The myth of the cave. Suppose there are prisoners kept in a dark cave, and they're chained so they cannot move. They're facing the back wall of the cave. always. They're chained up. But there's some light coming in from the wall, from the front of the cave. So projected against the wall of the cave, they see shadows of what's going on outside. People, carts, animals walking by. They're constantly watching these shadows. It's the only reality they know, is the shadows projected on the wall. They think that that's the real world. Two-dimensional, just all shadows. And you can't touch it, you can't do anything with it, all you can do is watch. But suppose one of those prisoners breaks his chains and escapes. He walks out of the cave. First thing he experiences is that he's blinded. He's not accustomed to the light. For some few minutes he can't see anything, he's blinded. Then he gets his vision back after adjusting. And he sees, everything I was looking at all my life were just the shadows of these other things out here. The reality is out here, outside the cave. Amazing. There's a real world out here. Let me go back into the cave and tell everybody. I'll cut their chains and let them all out. So he goes back in order to preach to deliver the other prisoners. But they refuse to listen to him. Plato says, or Socrates says, eventually they killed him. To shut him up, they killed him. They didn't want to leave. They didn't believe what he was saying. So this is the predicament. The living entities are satisfied with just watching the show of the shadows against the wall, not knowing that they're a reflection of the reality that will give actual satisfaction, the real life. And they won't believe it, even when someone tries to tell them that there's a real life outside the cave. They'll kill them, even. So this is the predicament of those who are trying to enlighten those who want to remain in ignorance. They don't want to be enlightened. They have to be induced by some tricks to accept the knowledge. Unless that knowledge is received of the real life, the real world, we won't want to give up the inferior world. Param drishtva nivartate. By experiencing the higher thing, you'll be interested to give up the inferior thing. But you have to have at least some theoretical experience of it. At least it has to be presented to you mentally. So something you can think about in your mind, some image of the reality. You cannot simply give someone the spiritual world, tap him on the head and he'll get a vision. That's not the way it's supposed to be done. No one is supposed to be allowed to see the spiritual world unless he has love of God. So those who are envious and ignorant, they have to remain in illusion. The preachers, all they can do is try to explain in words and sometimes in visual images what the spiritual world is like. This is the job of the Vedic sages, beginning with the ancient rishis of the Rig Veda, down to Vyasadeva, who appeared only 5,000 years ago, relatively recent sage, and down to our own times. Our Vaishnavacharyas are also revealing this truth to us in the same way. They're telling us in books, shastras, and sometimes in visual arts, and in poetry and drama and music, in whatever form people can be attracted to. They're depicting, this is what the real life is like. This is how it's organized. This is the dynamics of the spiritual world. This is what it looks like. These are the kind of people who live there. This information is this propaganda to inform the conditioned souls about their real life. This is the essence of preaching. We begin with elementary topics. You're not this body. Because you have to prepare someone to understand the glories of the spiritual world. If someone is still attached to his ignorance, then he's not ready yet to understand the spiritual life. It is the ninth offense against the holy name. to preach the glories of the holy name to those who are still materialistically attached and cannot hear. You have to first prepare someone to hear, to be able to hear about it. Then you give them the real information. So therefore, Bhagavad Gita begins with discussion about how the spirit soul is different than the body. These elementary things have to be settled first. Srila Prabhupada came to us. We were in deep ignorance, and therefore he talked about basic things. People may criticize, oh, you're Swami Prabhupada, you're Bhaktivedanta. He didn't talk about the real nectar. He didn't talk about Rasalila, about Radha Krishna Lila. And this other Acharya is doing that. He's better. No, Prabhupada did what was necessary and appropriate. He told us the things we had to hear because we were not prepared yet to simply sit and hear the intimate activities of Krishna and his pleasure potency. We have to become fit first. It is a fence to preach these intimate things to those who are not ready to hear them. Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur especially warned his disciples not to do that, not to prematurely introduce the intimate topics of Krishna's Leela to people who are not ready for it. These things should not be discussed in general public among people who cannot understand. First, prepare them to understand. Srimad Bhagavatam is meant to prepare us to understand the most intimate aspects of God's relationships with his devotees. Study Srimad Bhagavatam, then you'll be ready to enter the understanding of Krishna's intimate Leela. Even in the 10th canto, the presentation is very careful. Even in the chapters that discuss the Ras Leela, it is very tactfully presented so that conditioned souls can also gradually understand it. Yes, Krishna comes to perform his pastimes to attract us. Bhajate tadrisha krida yashrutva tatparo bhavet. Krishna performs wonderful activities for one purpose. One of the purposes is that we will become attracted to him by hearing those topics. Yashrutva tatparo bhavet. But he doesn't reveal himself indiscriminately. Even 5,000 years ago, when his manifestation, when his avatar, his appearance was public, and anybody could come to Vrajadam. Many people who were living quite close could not understand the importance of Gokula Vraja. People living 11 kilometers away in Mathura, they had a different conception of God. Our God, Krishna, is the king, is the royal prince of the Yadus, the supreme personality of Godhead, the Lord of Vaikuntha, the super soul. And therefore we worship him here in Mathura with all awe and reverence. And we always want to see him as the great king. And we worship him like a king with Raj Bhoga. That is the mood of Mathura. And just on the other side of the river, there's a whole different mood. And by the power of Yogamaya, even the persons living just on the other side of the river cannot understand that mood. Krishna doesn't reveal himself indiscriminately. Even the Mathuravasis living a few kilometers away cannot understand the intimate, fully understand the intimate loving mood of Vrindavan. So it's not that Krishna just shows himself to everybody the same way. He doesn't. He's tactful about how he reveals himself. Only he reveals himself to the degree that his devotees are capable of understanding him, and in the way they're capable of understanding. Ye yatam mam prapadyante tam stataiva bhajamyaham. In that statement, Krishna is not just talking about his business dealings with the conditioned souls. As they offer something to me, I reciprocate. Someone gives me $100, I give him $100,000 back. It's not just those calculations, how he deals with materialistic people. It's also how he deals with his pure devotees. According to their different moods of devotion, I reciprocate in those particular rasas, and it's different. The most intimate rasas are only shown to certain specially qualified devotees. Kamsa, he's king. He can travel around the countryside freely. Who's going to stop him to cross the river and go to Goloka, Gokula? He tried it once. I don't know the authenticity of this story, but I've heard it, that he came to Vrindavan with, you know, all these deputies I've sent to kill Krishna and Balaram. They, you know, they all got killed by them. Incompetent. Let me go try it myself. I'll go to Vrindavan, see what I can do. But he went there, and when I don't know the whole story correctly, maybe someone knows it better, but he encountered, I think, Purnamasi and Vrindadevi, I think. And they asked him what he's up to. He said, well, you know, he had himself disguised. I don't know. As a woman, maybe, he disguised himself. I'm sorry if I'm not telling the story right. Yes, do you know the story? He told it? Okay. Because I may not even heard the whole story. Anyway, I'll just tell you the part of it I know. So they, you know, the idea is, if a woman claims to be a Brijvasi, then the Brijvasi's ladies will say, well, show me your hands. If the hands aren't black, forget it. You know, that means that you're not busy every day making gover patties. You know, your hands are clean. That means you're not a Brijvasi. Forget it. So they to test Kamsa, anyway, they knew he was cheating, he was lying. They sat him down and said, you know, can you help us a little bit? So they sat him down to make cow patties. And, you know, and gave him a big amount of cow dung to deal with. And so he was working on it for hours, and finally he got frustrated. Like, this is too much. He couldn't take, and he went back to Mathura. I'm sorry if I didn't tell the story right. I should keep the things I know.
Curse also, no?
The Lamanga Guru once said that Purnamasi kicked him.
Yes?
And then he just woke up in the pillar. Not that point where there's been down Purnamasi turns.
Yes, yes.
So
that's where it happened.
Yeah, but he came from the not on that main road.
Yes.
There's one.
The path. The Parakram path between Vrindavan and Mathura.
Yeah.
Along the river, yeah.
So he came to that point and Purnamasi just and they made his test and then kicked him. He just woke up.
I also heard that he was cursed also, that in future if he would try to come
again,
he would become I don't know, eunuch or something.
He would become a
woman. Woman, yeah.
Hare Krishna. So anyway, it's not that he can't do it. Krishna doesn't reveal himself to those who are not fit. He reveals himself in different ways, even to his different devotees. If you want Krishna to reveal himself, therefore, you have to become qualified. You have to learn first the basics. And if you have a particular desire to serve Krishna in a certain way, you have to be trained up in that mood of service. Those are the higher aspects of devotional service. Getting our spiritual training to actually enter the spiritual world, enter our relationship with Krishna. At least we should start with the basics. This material world is not my home. I don't have to suffer these restrictions, these limitations on my freedom. I can be a free soul. I can live and enjoy life in the company of the Supreme Person in the spiritual world. Yo veda nihitam guhayam sa ashnute sarvakaman sabamana vipaschita. One who can understand that God is in his heart can find the presence of the Supreme Person, either as a Supersoul or as Bhagavan, either form. But even if all you can do is realize the Supersoul, then you can establish your relationship with him. So shnute. This is Taittiriya Upanishad. So ashnute sarva karma kaman. He can enjoy the fulfillment of all his desires. And not only that, not only some selfish fulfillment of your desires. Who knows what your desires might be? They may not be appropriate. But you can enjoy the fulfillment of all your desires in the company of the absolute supreme personality of Godhead. In other words, you can enter his pastimes, and then all your real desires will be fulfilled. But you must understand the Lord. You must get this transcendental knowledge, beginning with the basics. So here the basics are being presented. Third canto. That here's the material world. The living entity is a foreigner here. He's been put into this place, but it's not his real place. He doesn't have to actually suffer these restrictions and this loss of freedom. Anyway, that's what we're being taught. So I'll stop here. Are there any questions or comments? Hare Krishna.
Maharaj, yes.
Yes, Maharaj. First comes Pradhan. It evolves into the Mahatattva. Both of them are invisible. Nobody can see them except maybe a few yogis. Or Vishnu himself can see, Prakriti can see. But everyone else, except for those with a few people with special yogic vision, Jai Shri Krishna, can't even see the Mahatattva or the Pradhan. So how can they tell the difference? We only know the difference from what's told to us by scripture. The difference is that in the Mahatattva, the three modes of nature have become, the balance has become upset. In Pradhan, the original state of nature, everything is in perfect equilibrium. So nothing happens. Nothing evolves. The evolution of material existence occurs when the equilibrium, the balance of sattva, rajas, and tamas, they're all there, but they're all just doing nothing because they're just in equal balance, equilibrium. When that equilibrium is disturbed, then things start to evolve. That disturbed condition of nature, that is the Mahatattva. That's why it's said in this verse, Mahatattva predominated by Rajogun. Because it goes through phases. And it starts, what does the agitating is the glance of Mahavishnu. The glance of Mahavishnu agitates the Pradhan, and then Pradhan turns into Mahatattva. It's just a change of condition. When it becomes agitated, then it's the same Prakriti becomes called Mahatattva. And first of all, the mode of goodness becomes prominent. There's more goodness. But then that changes, and then there's more passion. That's the stage that this verse is describing. From Mahatattva evolved in the mode of passion, or predominated by passion, then these things evolve. And then, third phase, the predominance of Rajas will pass, and then Tamas will become prominent. Then the gross elements, the gross creation evolves. From what's called Bhutadi, or Mahatattva predominated by the mode of ignorance. Anyway, the difference is that in the Mahat, the modes of nature become unsettled, agitated, and out of balance, and therefore things start evolving.
When it is said that when the Supreme Lord desires to create, then the spiritual sky, in one corner of the spiritual sky, the cloud of Mahatattva manifests.
Yes.
So, like you said, that Pradhan is the beginning, and
then
when it is agitated, then it becomes
Mahatattva.
So then, what is that cloud?
That is Pradhan.
That is Pradhan.
And actually, it's eternal. It doesn't go out of existence and come back. It may not be manifest. It may be hiding. But it's always there. Pradhana is material nature in her original form is eternal. Maybe the term is used, but it's really Pradhan. Before the glance, it should be properly termed Pradhan.
Basically, what you are saying, there is no difference between Pradhan and Mahatattva, except before the glance.
Yeah, yeah, it's Pradhan changes its condition and becomes Mahatattva. They are separate in the sense that after pradan turns into mahatattva, it doesn't completely transform. There's still pradan. Inside the pradan, some portion of it becomes mahatattva. But surrounding, enveloping the mahatattva is still the original pradan. So the causal ingredient, after it evolves into something else, still exists. When you take gold and make some of the gold into a gold ring, there's still gold left over. You haven't used up all the gold in the world to make one ring. You never use it all up, no matter how many gold things you make. There's always some reserve of gold. Like that, even after the mahatattva is produced, the original pradhan is still there. And it's bigger. There's more pradhan than mahatattva. So they are separate. They're that way. Yeah, mahatattva, because it's going to become mahatattva. As soon as it gets glanced upon, it will turn into mahatattva. It's potentially mahatattva. Just like this man is the cook. But he's sitting in class. He's not cooking. Okay, but after class, he's going to go cook. He's not cooking 24 hours a day, but he has the potential to cook. So we call him the cook. Even when he's not cooking, he's the cook. So this pradhan is mahatattva because it becomes periodically mahatattva. Just like this man periodically goes into the kitchen and does some cooking. So we call him the cook. We can call the pradhan mahatattva because it frequently becomes mahatattva. It frequently serves that function. Just like the man frequently serves the function of cooking. So we call him the cook. Even if he's not cooking all the time.
And this mahatattva is nothing but the aggregate of all these 24 elements, right?
Yes. And they haven't yet separated. When they separate, then the elements, and it's called by the name of the elements.
That's by the glance only, when that equilibrium is disturbed, then this...
All star has to start with the glance, yeah. There's nothing else that can start it.
But again, in 24 elements, sometimes Prabhupada also describes the 24th element is pradhan.
Because the total stock of pradhan remains, and the mahatattva doesn't completely get used up when the elements are evolved from it. So the mahatattva and pradhana is still there, even after everything, all the separate elements evolve, even after the whole universe evolves.
So there actually some total of all material elements.
Yes, but in its earlier form, in its primeval form, unseparated form.
But how pradhana can be considered one of the elements, like for the fourth element, when it is some total of all the elements?
It's the first element. All the elements evolve from it, but it remains even after everything else has evolved from it. So it can be given a separate, considered a separate category, because it exists separately even after the creation is finished.
It's like one may use sunlight in a solar station.
Yes.
And use sunlight to generate some electricity.
Yes.
And still sunlight also remains.
Sunlight remains. You don't use it all up.
You don't use it all. So it's something like that.
Yes. It's not depleted by evolving. Just like the Supreme Lord is not at all depleted. But even the material elements are not completely depleted when they evolve into grosser elements. They remain. So therefore we have the later elements and also the previous elements are still there. Causal ocean and the Viraja River. No, they're the same. They're just looking from different viewpoints. If we look from the outside, from the inside out.
From material to spiritual.
Yeah, we're inside the material egg. It looks like it's surrounding the egg, like a river, like some thin membrane. If we're on the outside looking in, then it looks like the causal ocean. It's the same. It's just looking in from different viewpoints. It's just, the different perspective of our vision, whether you're inside looking out or outside looking in. I don't think that's contradicted. I think the Shastra will confirm that the Viraja and the Karana Arnava are the same. Okay, I'm not familiar with that, the difference.
Viraja is the same river which is also considered the boundary between the material and the spiritual world.
Yes. As far as I understood, it's the same. Maybe you can point out to me what
then
the difference.
Then again, it says that all the material planets are floating in Padmasambhava.
Well, because all the universes are floating in the Mahatattva, and the Mahatattva is floating in the Pradhana. So everything is floating in the Pradhana.
So that means this Virata River is not encircling the spiritual world, actually it is encircling the material universe.
Not encircling, it's the whole thing, the whole total of everything material is just one little blob in the corner in the spiritual world. So therefore it looks like a spherical some blob, and a small one. And that's called the causal ocean. But that same causal ocean, when you're on the inside of it, looking inside the egg, looking out, it seems to be a shell surrounding on the outside. So you call it a river. But it's actually the same thing, as far as I understand.
Now in Chaitanya Bhagavat, where it talks about in Orissa, the river, Virija River, near Jajpur.
Yes.
And Chaitanya Bhagavat says that this is non-different from that Virija River. Anybody who crosses this river,
yes,
he is actually crosses beyond birth and death.
Yes.
Of course, we can understand.
The Lord's spiritual abodes replicate themselves on the earth in different tirthas. Goloka manifests itself, reflects itself as Gokula.
There's
different parts of Vaikuntha that appear, especially in South India.
Yeah.
So also, why not? This is also a dham, abode of the Lord. The pastime of glancing on Prakriti, the Lord performs that pastime in that place, in the Pradhan. So the Pradhan is also his abode. So it also has its, the Viraja River also has its replica on the earth. Why not?
And that is the same which comes as Ganges when Lord Vishnu is.
Yeah, well, Ganges is you know.
Charanamrita.
There's a hole in this egg, and some of the causal ocean leaks in. That's the Ganga. Yes, but the Ganga is not the whole causal ocean. It's
part.
Yeah, it's some of it leaking in.
And we say that this.
But then it touches the Lord's feet.
Yeah.
It's kicked by Lord Vamanadeva, so it gets special potency by that. It's not only causal ocean, but it's specially empowered, and so many blessings were given to Ganga. Yeah, so that makes it special.
One more question about the spiritual. When we say, like, even when there is pralay, these spiritual abodes like Jagannath Puri and Vrindavan and Navadvip, they are not destroyed. So
destroyed? Certainly not destroyed, because they're eternal.
That, of course, with faith we understand it's literally true. That means even if suppose there is a pralay. Filled with water, or say, let's say, Delhi, someplace.
Or the end of the universe.
Yeah.
And everything merges back into Pratan.
But these places, they are eternally there.
It doesn't say eternally manifest, visible. Visible to whom? Because there's nobody there to see it. Yeah. There's only the inhabitants of the spiritual world are looking down. But they see the original places anyway. They don't see some reflection.
And that traditional story of
you can't have a reflection on the surface of the earth when there's no surface of the earth to reflect on. So it's not existing in the same form.
But like the story of Markandeya Rishi, you know, he had asked for a benediction. And
yes.
He saw everything was surrounded with water.
Yes.
Finally, he took shelter of Navadvip through the.
Yes.
That means even after everything is surrounded with water, Navadvip, Vrijadham, they retain.
Well, that was a partial annihilation of the universe. It was not even the end of a Manvantara. It was just special show for Markandeya. Well, it was the end of a Manvantara, but it was not the end of Brahma's day. Normally, there's not a flooding of the whole universe at the end of each Manvantara, but for Markandeya, it was arranged. So that's a little different because. The higher planets were still remaining.
But I could not understand the word you used, reflection. Is this...
Well, yeah, it can't be taken too literally.
Yeah, it's not exactly a reflection, because the replica is a more appropriate word. Because
well, replica in the sense of the same thing. Just like in this fantasy television program, Star Trek, they have this machine that, you know, they make food by just putting one item of that one apple in the machine, and then another apple comes out. So it's actually supposed to be, you know, the same atomic structure the machine can create. It can replicate anything.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. It's exactly the same thing. not just a picture of it or an image of it.
The reflection would connote a sense of inferiority. Like,
yeah, well, when you say reflection, you mean that the reflection in the mirror is not the real thing. It's just an image.
The material world can be said to be a reflection.
So replica maybe is a better word. Yeah.
Sorry for that. So that means, these, as we explained, that when the pralaya occurs, these dham, they will remain, or when there's complete annihilation, then they will not remain.
Well, they won't remain in the same context, but the context is removed. They're not in the same physical location because the physical location has been destroyed.
Mm-hmm.
But they're present. And they're not visible to everyone because everyone's gone. Everyone's dead. So who are they visible to? But they're still there.
Yes, too.
But that's true of all the Lord's abodes. They're eternal.
Like the world, of course.
But then there's some of them that have special qualities. Like this Akshayavata. That actually may never go away. That means the central portion of Puri.
Yeah.
It says that it never disappears. So
Neelachal, right?
Yes,
yeah.
The Neelachal hill. But Dwarka, as soon as Krishna left, as soon as the Yadus were killed, within 12 days it was flooded and disappeared. No annihilation of the universe, just Dwarka disappeared. So that also happens. There's manifestation and removal of the manifestation. Vajradham will disappear in 5,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
There won't be any trace of it left.
Vajradham?
Yeah. Vrindavanam will disappear completely. Govardhan will disappear. It will all disappear.
5,000.
5,000, I think, yeah. I guess, okay, 10,000. Yeah, at the end of 10,000 years, it'll all be gone. Gone.
It will disappear.
Disappear completely. Hare Krishna.
That must be Govardhan and Jamuna, they will be separate before that?
After 10,000 years, yeah. They're already in the process of disappearing.
Yeah.
Sorry, but...
Before that, you have to make it.
Yeah, do what we can for 10,000 years, because it'll be more difficult after that. Bhavatam will be there, but you won't be able to see it with your own eyes.
You'll not be able to?
The description of the Bhavatam will remain.
Yeah.
But you won't be able to show people, and they won't be able to see with their own eyes and touch it and smell it. It won't be there. But for the next 5,000 years, it'll become more manifest. You know, and then it'll decrease. Yes?
Why is the abode of Lord Shiva, like it said that it is beyond the material world and in between spiritual and
he has two
world?
Yes.
That means it is Brahmajyoti?
He has two principal abodes in the material world. He has his original abode in the spiritual, but in the material world. There, according to Sanatana Goswami and Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's Kailasa.
Himalayas.
Yes, in Himalayas, which is actually the abode of Kuvera. But Shiva and Kuvera are good friends, and Kuvera has given Kailash Mountain to Lord Shiva. But that's his secondary abode. His primary abode in the material world is in the last covering of material elements, the covering of Ahankara. That is the ultimate abode of Lord Shiva in the material world. There he manifests much more opulence than he does in Kailas on the earth.
That means it is within this material world?
Just barely within. The last
that's
covering. The last covering of false ego.
He is a predominating deity of Ahankara.
Yes, and that's his dham. That's his headquarters in the material world.
It's the thickest,
world.
Right? That last one is the thickest. Every layer is 10 times thicker.
It's the biggest, yeah. 10 times bigger than the one inside, which means it's 10 times 14 times bigger than the first shell, than the universe itself. I mean, much bigger. I don't know what you call it, not even quadrillions, more than that. 10 to the 14th power times bigger than the universe on the inside. Very big.
10 to the power of 14, something like that.
13 or 14, yeah. That's because you have that many. Why 13? I guess you have some extra shells.
It should be 8, no?
But I don't know, but there's some calculation by Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati where it ends up as 10 to the 13th power, the ultimate outside of the universe, of the last shell.
Besides that, here the Sadashiva is the eternal, that Sadashiva is
But that Sadashiva in Vaikuntha is actually Vishnu. Okay?
That is mentioned here.
Shiva as such appears in the material world.
So that means after last you must have gone, then there were some steps?
Yes. Dvaraj River is next, exactly adjacent to the shell of false ego.
And beyond that is the Vaikuntha planets.
Yes.
And that first of them is Sadashiva.
I don't know.
Because the Goloka Namini Dham, the Devi.
No, no, but that Mahesha Dham is the shell of false ego.
Oh yeah.
Hari Dham, Vaikuntha is Hari Dham. Sadashiva is one of the forms of Hari, so it's part of Vaikuntha.
Then what about Brahmajyoti?
Brahmajyoti is just the atmosphere of Vaikuntha. The substance of Vaikuntha is Vishuddha Sattva. So even where there's no particular manifestation, there is that atmosphere, that divine light, Brahmajyoti. That's just, all the Vaikuntha planets are sitting in that Brahmajyoti.
But that is the spiritual sky?
Yes.
All the planets are floating in that spiritual sky.
Yes.
And all this impersonalists, they go there?
The followers of Shankaracharya, the Mayavadis, go there, if they're successful. Not all the Mayavadis, the graduates who actually succeeded, they can go there.
The
Buddhists go to the causal ocean. That's their aim. The successful Buddhists go not to a bright, warm place, they go to a cold, dark place, namely the causal ocean.
Called what? What
do you
call it? Buddhists.
Where do they go?
Causal ocean. If they do, if they're successful
nirvana.
Buddhists, their nirvana is attained in the by merging into the causal ocean.
And when it is said that my Islam is never annihilated,
maybe referring to Sadashiva planet.
Well, position of Lord Shiva is special. He doesn't have a material body. So his body is eternal, and therefore his abode is also eternal. But it's not eternally manifested. When the whole universe is dissolved back into Pradhan, then that shell of false ego will also be dissolved. So it won't be manifest. Lord Shiva's abode may be eternal, but it won't be manifest when there's total annihilation. He goes back into the body of Mahavishnu with everybody else. And his abode goes back into the body of Mahavishnu then when the universe is totally annihilated. He comes out. The fact that he comes out in the glance must mean that before he came out, he was inside. So in the period between creations, Lord Shiva is residing within the body of Mahavishnu.
Yes,
and that's
like
where his abode goes in there too. Into
just
the body.
Like all other living entities who have unfulfilled desires, same way.
Yes, but it's described, both are described. The living entities come out of the glands, but Shambhu also appears from the glands. So that means he was inside before the glands. He's inside, that means his abode is inside also. All his entourage and his whole abode are inside the body of Mahavishnu when there's no creation.
And then the Rudra, which comes out from the glands of Brahma, that is a further expansion of...
Further expansion, yes.
So there are three...
The original expansion is from the glands of Mahavishnu.
From Sadashiva down to the Shankar and then to Rudra.
Yes.
Three.
Well, there are 11 Rudras. Description of the one Rudra, and then he expands into 11 Rudras. And then there's many Rudras. Yeah. But 11 categories of Rudras. Lord Rudra controls 11 different elements. So there are Shivalingas in these 11 different elements.
It's interesting that Advaita Acharya is an incarnation of Mahavishnu and Sadashiva, according to Chaitanya Bhagavad.
Yes.
That means Mahavishnu, Sadashiva is also in Mahavishnu.
Right? Yes. I'm not sure how to explain that. I won't even try to explain that.
The same person is simply chanting and dancing with Chaitanya Mahaprabhu.
Yes. But he's Vishnu.
He's Vishnu.
Yeah, so he's Shiva, but he's the original Shiva, the Vishnu version of Shiva. Vishnu Tattva. So I think what it is that actually it's one, it's not two separate forms. But that Sadashiva expands into both Mahavishnu and Shambhu. So that's the sense. Advaitacharya is both because he's the source of both of them. Not that they're two separate things. They are two separate, they become two separate things, but he's the original form from which both separate things come from. Yeah. I think. This is, my guess. Okay. I think if I speculate anymore, I'll get in trouble. So let's just stop here. Starting to speculate. Yes.
More discussion during prasadam.
Okay, but not officially.
Not officially.
Okay, so we'll stop here. Thank you. All glory to Srila Prabhupada. Srimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Yeah.